Information is free.
The law?
There is hope.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge.
Tonight, we care,
appear to border
and it shows.
The law?
The country.
You will remember nothing you have seen or heard here.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not go on with it, made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th. Or should we? Welcome, my friends, to episode 83 of MediaMonarchy.com. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com. Coming to you 7/11/2008 from the Portland Radio Authority and the Revere Radio Network. Media Monarchy is your home for news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups. And today is a doozy. We got Hauer and Hatfield and Hopsicker and Hirsch and Hitler and Bush and Lieberman and Rove and McCain and Mugabe and Paul and pot and opium and shrooms and 2012, the telecoms, the torture, all that and more. 7/11/2008, episode 83. It's MediaMonarchy.com.
They want our way of life. Well, they can take mine any time they like. Cause God knows I know I ain't living right. I'm wrong. Oh, I know I'm so wrong. Not one single soul was saved. I was ordering an Indian takeaway. I was spared whilst others went to an early grave. Got stoned. Yeah, went out and got stoned. Survive. they can take mine any time they like.
That's Jarvis Cocker with a track off of last year's self-titled solo debut. That's From Auschwitz to Ipswich. I've been digging back into that record, and that song kind of haunts me. I recommend you go back and listen to it again. But welcome yet again, my friends, to MediaMonarchy.com. This is episode 83. It's July 11th, 2008. My name's James Evan Pilato, coming to you live every Friday morning at 10 Pacific Time on the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, and Sunday nights at 7 Eastern Time, revereradio.info. And you can, of course, hit me up on MySpace, Dig, YouTube, and Yahoo. You can also give it a shot. I'm working on integrating the IM and the Skype and the Twitter, and it's all still Media Monarchy as your keyword. RadioForAll.net had been doing an update over the last week, so I don't have episode 82 up there yet with Warren from last week, but I'm working on it. They still got some bugs, but you can always get the show from archive.org, or you could even just subscribe to the mediamonarchy.blogspot.com/atom.xml, and that'll get it through iTunes and all that. Blah, blah, blah. But I appreciate you getting the show, and actually, I gotta give yet another grateful thanks and shout-out to my man Johnny Nitro in Atlanta and Ground Zero Radio 87.9 FM rebroadcasting Media Monarchy. So I love you, and I thank you. So here we are on this July 11th, 2008 in downtown Portland, Oregon. On my way here, I saw lots of iPhone idiots lined up to get their latest gadget while the fighter jets zoom overhead. And so this week, we're going to get into tons and tons and tons of news, and even some of the stuff we weren't able to get into last week with Warren. I'm going to do my best. It's a lot. I urge you to check out MediaMonarchy.com. There's all kinds of links, all kinds of resources for you to do your own research, and tons of audio and video and PDFs and tons. It's all there, MediaMonarchy.com. So let's go right now to the top of the page. WTC7 emergency head was building collapse specialist. Now this is coming from Paul Joseph Watson, and we're going to be talking about a guy named Jerome Hauer. H-A-U-E-R. This is not the first time we've talked about Jerome Hauer, and it will not be the last time. The former New York City Chief Emergency Manager, Jerome Hauer, whose office was on the 23rd floor of World Trade Center Building 7, was also a building collapse specialist, according to a recently uncovered New York Times article. Hauer has attracted suspicion from the 9/11 truth movement because of his zeal to push the official story in the hours after the attack, when details were still sketchy. Hauer was managing director of Kroll Associates, K-R-O-L-L, the company that provided security for the World Trade Center complex on 9/11. And he also betrayed advance knowledge of the anthrax attacks a week before they happened. And we're going to get to that late in the show, but right now, let's listen to Dan Rather and Jerome Hauer on 9/11.
You served as the commissioner for Mayor Giuliani's Office of Emergency Management. Based on what you know, and I recognize we're dealing with so few facts, is it possible that just a plane crash could have collapsed these buildings, or would it have required the sort of prior positioning of other explosives in the building? What do you think?
No, my sense is that just one, the velocity of the plane and the fact that there were, you have a plane filled with fuel hitting that building that burned, the velocity of the plane certainly had an impact on the structure itself. And then the fact that it burned and you had that intense heat probably weakened the structure as well. And I think it was simply the planes hitting the buildings and causing the collapse. As you can see, the impact on the rescue workers, I mean, these people who are heroes in this building have been impacted by this, the number of people that have been injured, the number of police and fire officers, firefighters that have been injured is just, it's incalculable at this point.
What perspective can you give us? I mean, there have been these repeated reports that, well, yes, Osama bin Laden, but some think he's been overemphasized as responsible for these kinds of events. I know many intelligence people at very high levels who say, listen, you can't have these kinds of attacks without having some state, Iraq, Iran, Libya, Syria, somebody involved. Put
that into perspective for us.
Well, I'm not sure I agree that this is necessarily state-sponsored. It, as I mentioned earlier, certainly has fingerprints of somebody like Bin Laden.
Now, that's just the Jerome Hauer portion of the video that's embedded in that story. WTC7 emergency manager was building collapse specialist. But you should check out the video, the first part, because it's got this really suspicious guy on the scene who basically sounds exactly like he's reading a script about how the building's collapsed, mostly due to the fire. You gotta play it. I didn't add it along. Returning to the article from Paul Joseph Watson, in a July 27th, 1999, New York Times article unearthed by 9/11 blogger entitled, What Could Go Wrong? It's His Job to Know. Hauer is given a glowing write-up by journalist Randy Kennedy. Quote, There's one story he tells in which this fascination is quite literal, but another illustration, a bit more metaphorical, is hard to miss when you walk into his office on the 23rd floor of 7 World Trade Center, otherwise known as The Bunker, the $13 million bulletproof, hurricane-proof, blackout-proof emergency crisis center opened by the city last month. The article describes Building 7 for what it was, a structurally reinforced immovable object built for the express purpose of standing strong in a crisis situation, not the weakling tinderbox that allegedly became the first steel building in history to collapse from fire damage alone, according to, of course, all the debunkers like the BBC and the History Channel and Popular Mechanics and others. Indeed, as the New York Times quotes Lucky Larry Silverstein as stating in 1989, World Trade Center 7 designers, quote, built in enough redundancy to allow entire portions of floors to be removed without affecting the building's structural integrity, end quote. A solid structure that was again improved upon that year with more than 375 tons of steel, requiring 12 miles of welding. The article describes Hauer's roles, quote, as the city's chief emergency manager, Mr. Hauer oversees the response to building collapses, of which there have been no shortage over the past 3 years. That article goes on, and you should go down that rabbit hole, but that's just the first taste of all the latest 9/11 news that we're going to cover intermittently throughout episode 83 of Media Monarchy. So, next, not straying too far, no-show defendants and classified evidence. Hearing delayed after 9/11 defendant wouldn't come. This is from the Miami Herald and McClatchy. Alleged 9/11 hijack conspirator Ramzi bin al-Shib reportedly refused to leave his prison camp cell Thursday, that's yesterday, causing a military judge to postpone his hearing by a month. Quote, he wouldn't come, said attorney Anthony Romero of the ACLU. Romero said military staff at the war court notified observers of bin al-Shib's refusal to leave his Camp 7 cell as they waited at Camp Justice for his 8:30 a.m. military commission hearing. War court spokesmen were unable to confirm the report. They said only that bin al-Shib's appearance was postponed until a mental health competency hearing on August 15th. Bin al-Shib, 36, is one of five former CIA-held Guantanamo captives accused as co-conspirators in the 9/11 attack. The next one, also McClatchy, also Miami Herald. 9/11 defendant argues to see classified evidence. An alleged al-Qaeda fighter accused of training the 9/11 hijacker sought access to classified evidence Thursday, that's yesterday, reassuring the war court here that once convicted, he'll take U.S. secrets to his grave. Quote, if I'm going to receive the death sentence, this evidence will go with me, declared Walid bin Attash, a one-legged Yemeni captive accused of running an al-Qaeda camp in Afghanistan. After execution, he said, the secrets, quote, will be better protected than in the hands of the FBI and CIA. Bin Attash made the remarks at a hearing before Judge Ralph Coleman, a Marine colonel who will preside at the war crimes trial of five Guantanamo captives. At least four of the men want to defend themselves. Coleman has been warning them that even as their own lawyers, they can't see or challenge classified evidence until their trial. We shall see. Our first of wild left turns here that we're going to make many on this episode. Posted up under GW's Masonic Bowl, Patented Pot, and Airport Highs, three stories concerning marijuana. First, from my man at total411.info, found George Washington's Masonic Bowl. Everybody knows that George Washington grew and smoked hemp. Now, an important archaeological discovery is announced by the George Washington Foundation on July 2nd. The George Washington Foundation, GWF, announced on July 2nd, 2008, that archaeologists working at the site of George Washington's childhood home have located and excavated the remains of the long-sought house where Washington was raised. The archaeologists are particularly interested in a broken-off bowl of a pipe, blackened inside from heavy use, that was typical of the mid-18th century when George lived in the house. Found in one of the cellars, the pipe bears a clear Masonic crest. George Washington joined the Fredericksburg Lodge of the Masons in 1753. You have to hit up this link because you have to see this hundreds of years old pipe with a Masonic logo on it. If we jump to normal.org, brought to me by Disinfo, U.S. government patents medical pot. The extent of the federal government's hypocrisy on the issue of medical cannabis, medicinal cannabis, truly knows no bounds. Don't believe me? Check this out. You can see the scan and you can click over to the patent office and see. U.S. Patent 6630507, cannabinoids as antioxidants and neuroprotectants, application filed on February 2nd, 2001. U.S. Patent issued on October 7th, 2003. Assignee, the United States of America, as represented by the Department of Health and Human Services. And in that, there you have it. The same federal government that steadfastly denies pot has any medicinal value also holds the medical patents on the plant's various therapeutic cannabinoids. And they aren't the only ones who do. You got to hit that link and go to normal.org to read more. The final in the hat trick of weed stories. This one from Raw Replay, and our first bit of amazing, entertaining propaganda from the Masters, Fox News. This is the first one we're going to hit. A group called Safer, they want to allow pot in airports to reduce anxiety. Fox News' Trace Gallagher talked to Mason Tivert, T-V-E-R-T, who is the executive director of Safer, a group advocating for the legalization of marijuana. SaferChoice.org. Tarvert's group is calling to allow for the use of marijuana in airports to reduce the anxiety of travelers.
And here's one of the hot topics of the week. You know, airports nationwide could soon give new meaning to the phrase the Mile High Club. A group of activists called SAFER, which stands for Safer Alternative for Enjoyable Recreation, are asking why people are not allowed to smoke marijuana in airport lounges. The group claims that many people who have anxiety about flying are stuck with the options of alcohol and over-the-counter medications to calm their jitters. But if passengers could smoke marijuana before the flight, then everyone on the plane would be more chilled out, right? Mason Tivert is the executive director for Safer, and John Richardson is a criminal defense attorney and former prosecutor. They join me now. And Mason, where do you get the whole Safer act? I mean, what makes you safer? You smoke dope and all of a sudden you're safe to get on a plane? Where do you get that?
Well, every objective study on marijuana has concluded that it's far less harmful than alcohol, not only to the people who use it, but to those around them.
Well,
it doesn't
far less
contribute
harmful
to
doesn't exactly equate
violence.
To safer, though, right? Why don't we call it far less harmful alternative to getting on a plane?
Well, yeah, it's far less harmful. Alcohol has been found to contribute to violent and aggressive behavior, and we've seen quite a bit of that here on flights, in which passengers have gotten drunk and assaulted other passengers, flight attendants, and even their children. So we're simply saying that if we can allow adults to get drunk before getting on flight, maybe we'd be better off if we let some of those adults make the safer, rational choice to use marijuana instead when they fly.
John Richardson, can you imagine going to an airport and seeing the smoking lounge and then a separate smoking lounge where everybody in there is just kind of sitting back getting high? I mean, what do you tell your kids? Are they just in there kind of getting high?
Well, look, no, I can't imagine because, it's never going to happen. If you think the federal government is going to allow the Denver airport to turn their Starbucks or something like it into basically drug traffickers, allow them to sell pot or bring pot into a federally regulated public place, you're nuts. You're basically inviting drug dealers, criminals, into federally regulated places. Federal agents have to profile trial in order to catch criminals, drug dealers. If everybody's sitting in the same pot, smoke-filled room, how do you tell the difference between Jerry Garcia fan and a drug dealer? And this is something different.
Mason, here's what the emailers are saying right now. They're saying, you know, you can go into a lounge in a bar and you can sip a glass of wine and it does not make you drunk. You go into a smoking lounge and you smoke a joint, you're high. No matter how you shake it, you're high. So how do you equate that? I mean, there's a big difference between having a beer in a bar and having a glass of wine and then going and smoking a joint. You're not drunk when you come out of the bar, but you would be high when you came out of the smoking lounge.
Well, you could be as high as possible and you still pose less harm to yourself and those around you than having that one martini. It's simply a fact that when we let adults use alcohol, inevitably some of them are going to be irresponsible and they're going to lend to these serious problems. And I think it's upsetting that this attorney is kind of making a joke out of this. It's not going to be funny when a drunk person causes a serious problem on an airline that puts all the other passengers' safety in jeopardy. So we need to really think about this seriously. And
go ahead, John. You got 15 seconds.
I do think about it seriously. I don't see how that allowing people to smoke pot while other people are drinking makes things safer. Look, in respect to this gentleman, actually, I agree with you. I think they should legalize marijuana. Then you take the criminals and the drug traffickers out of it. Starbucks does not have to rely on criminals to import their coffee beans so we can get our caffeine fix. However, until the federal government legalizes marijuana, this is nothing more, in my opinion, than a publicity stunt because it's just not going to happen.
John, we got to go. John Richardson, Mason DeVert. Gentlemen, thank you.
Not the last of our, as Bill Hicks always called, a positive drug story. We got a couple more coming up in episode 83 of Media Monarchy. But right now we're going to shift gears to Bush's brain and other less savory words. Karl Rove avoids a subpoena by fleeing the country. This from thinkprogress.org. Karl Rove refused to appear before the House Judiciary Committee to testify about the politicization of the Justice Department, you know, firing all the guys, despite a subpoena. During a hearing, Representative Chris Cannon, Republican in Utah, revealed that Rove had not only skipped out of the hearing, but had skipped out of the entire country.
If you're aware that Mr. Rove is out of the country on a trip that was planned long before this hearing was set.
We have been in constant communication with his attorney and himself, and he has refused to testify not because it was inconvenient to his schedule, but because he is asserting that he is covered by an executive immunity claim.
So I take it you are aware that he is on a long planned trip, and this hearing was scheduled for our convenience, not his.
He did not. His attorney never mentioned it to us in all the numerous correspondence and specifically relating to the date that we asked him to come and appear before the subcommittee.
It was my understanding that he actually communicated that he had a trip planned and so could not be here today. Are you also aware?
We were not aware and we were not made aware by his attorney or by Mr. Rove himself.
So, was it known in advance? We don't know. Oh, I know the other word for Karl Rove other than Bush's brain. Turd blossom. That's the one. Back to the article from Think Progress. When Think Progress contacted Rove's lawyer, his office confirmed that Rove was out of the country on a trip scheduled long before the subpoena was sent. Representative Linda Sanchez said Rove's attorney never mentioned this trip to the committee. Rove's bogus claims of executive privilege were rejected by the committee as not valid by a 7-1 vote. The committee gave Rove 5 days to comply. You have 5 days to comply. The updates are Sanchez indicated she was unlikely to hold a contempt vote until late in the month, and Marcy Wheeler notes astutely that Bush did not, in fact, invoke executive privilege for Rove. And so one, or rather both of those links go to Fire Dog Lake. Let's shift gears again and get more serious. Rather than watching the puppets parade around on the stage and all their little moves, as of course Karl Rove said, you know, they are the history's great actors. They'll keep changing the story and we'll just keep following the bouncing ball. But let's get into a bit of health news. Posted up under the heading Biofuels, Pesticides, Vaccines, Bioterror, Wind, and Mars. First one, written by F. William Engdahl, over on globalresearch.ca. World Bank secret report confirms that biofuels are the cause of the world food crisis. Let's say that again. World Bank secret report confirms that biofuels are the cause of the world food crisis. Okay, it's not been made public on pressure from the Bush administration, but it concludes, this secret report from our good friends at the World Bank, concludes that biofuel cultivation, and especially the USA and EU, are directly responsible for the current explosion in grain and food prices worldwide. The U.S. government at the recent Rome UN Food Summit claimed that only 3% of food prices were due to biofuels. The World Bank secret report says that at least 75% of the recent price rises are due to land being removed from agriculture, mainly maize in North America and rapeseed and corn in the EU, in order to grow crops to be burned for vehicle fuel. Isn't that a great idea? Let's take food and shove it in your car. And it's not even like the souped-up DeLorean at the end of Back to the Future. The World Bank study confirms that what we wrote more than a year ago about the madness of biofuels, with a link for you, it fits the agenda described in the 1970s by Henry Heinz Kissinger, namely, quote, if you control the food, you control the people. And you can click that link and you can read about State Department Memorandum 200, Food as a Weapon. If we jump to the CBC, we can read about the CDC and their report on adverse reactions to Gardasil. We've covered this many a time on Media Monarchy, but here's some more for you. Almost 8,000 U.S. recipients of the vaccine used to protect against cervical cancer have reported adverse reactions ranging from pain at the injection site to serious side effects, says the U.S. Centers for Disease Control. A total of 7,802 people who received Gardasil made by our good friends at Merck have reported adverse events to the CDC's Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, VAERS, between June 8, 2006 and April 30, 2008. The U.S. distributed 2.2 million doses of the vaccine in 06 and 11.3 mil in 07. If we jump to terradaily.com, pesticides persist in groundwater. Numerous studies over the past four decades have established that pesticides, which are typically applied at the land surface, can move downward through the unsaturated zone to reach the water table at detectable concentrations. The downward movement of pesticide degradation products, again brought by our good friends at Monsanto and others, once in groundwater, pesticides and their degradation products can persist for years, depending upon the chemical structure of the compounds and the environmental conditions. Next, from the UPI and the Mooney Times, homeless die in Poland of bird flu vaccine. So here we go, classic human experimentation. Here, try this. 21 homeless individuals in Poland have died after being given an unproven bird flu virus vaccine. Prosecutors have accused three doctors and six nurses of misleading the homeless individuals by telling them they were being given a new influenza vaccine rather than a vaccine for the H5N1 bird flu virus. Link to the Daily Telegraph. Polish Health Minister Iwa Kopacz has condemned the alleged testing and called for a permanent ban on all involved personnel from future health treatment. Quote, it's in the interest of all doctors that those who are responsible for this are punished. Imagine that. I've got a link up for a short video. I'm not going to play a clip, but it's H5N1 DNA in flu vaccine, and it's Flu Mist, with a link for you. FluMist.com, and you can also hit up their Wikipedia entry. Flu Mist, a popular over-the-counter live flu vaccine, has been found to contain two H5N1 DNA markers. These markers seem to have been sewn into the Flu Mist vaccine to ensure that H5N1 or another strain of avian flu goes pandemic. This is going to cause major problems before long, and it's imperative that people are warned about Flu Mist. From Flu Mist to Tamiflu, which we covered a few weeks ago, and the deaths associated with Tamiflu and their makers, Roche, R-O-C-H-E. Roche is urging a stockpile of Tamiflu in case of a flu pandemic that will be created in some lab and it will accidentally get out during a drill. This from DB Techno. Roche, the makers of the leading bird flu vaccine, Tamiflu, are currently urging companies to stockpile the vaccine to better prepare for an influenza pandemic. Many scientists continue to be under the impression that it's only a matter of time before an influenza pandemic takes place. The belief is that Roche is doing this to both increase sales of its product and also to once again remind people of the major threat that is the bird flu. Remember to be scared. Oh, my God. Oh, God, it's under your bed. Jumping now to WorldNet Daily, CDC seals bioterror bugs with duct tape. Only 1 week following the annual duct tape festival, where enthusiasts fashion sculptures and share wacky applications for the adhesives, the Centers for Disease Control has revealed a unique high-tech use of its own, sealing off a potentially fatal bioterror bacteria. At its $214 million Emerging Infectious Diseases Laboratory in Atlanta, CDC scientists have been duct taping a lab door in an attempt to contain the airborne Q fever, with a link for you to read about the Q fever from the CDC themselves. And this comes from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. It's an enhancement, said Patrick Stockton, CDC Safety and Occupational Health Manager. Quote, we could take it off. Jumping to the AFP, China quake was very unusual, say U.S. scientists. The devastating earthquake in China was the unexpected result of a seismological oddity and is likely to occur in the area only about once in every 2 to 10,000 years. A team from MIT had studied the region around Sichuan province where the 7.9 magnitude quake hit on May 12th for more than 2 decades, but found nothing to warn them of a major quake. In a study published in the July issue of GSA Today, with a link for you, it's long, gsajournals.org, they blamed the tremor, which left 88,000 people dead or missing. They blamed it on the faults. Splits in the rock in the Earth's crust with very little seismic activity. The Las Vegas Review-Journal, I believe this is our only bit of sort of ufology that we're going to touch on. Ex-Area 51 workers eligible for aid. And I think I actually got this from military.com, but it originates from Las Vegas Review-Journal. Former Department of Energy and contractor employees who worked at the top-secret Area 51 base now are eligible to seek payments available to nuclear weapons workers who got sick from their jobs. So says a top federal official on June 24th. The announcement by Shelby Hallmark, director of the Office of Worker Compensation in the Labor Department, cleared an obstacle that has prevented some former Nevada workers from getting help to battle job-related cancers and other serious illnesses that showed up years after they completed careers at weapons sites. If we jump to my home state of West Virginia and Examiner.com, new West Virginia wind farm up and running. But there is a catch. A new wind farm located along the Allegheny Front in Grant County is generating electricity. Dominion Resources spokesman Carl Needian says some turbines at the Ned Power Mount Storm Wind Farm have been operating since the first of the year. Needian wouldn't say how many turbines are now generating electricity, says that the number of changes based on wind conditions at any given day change at all. Ned Power is jointly owned by Richmond, Virginia-based Dominion Resources and, of course, Shell Wind Energy Incorporated. The project's first phase involves 82 turbines capable of generating 164 megawatts of electricity. Dominion and Shell have said they plan 50 more turbines capable of generating 100 megawatts despite an ongoing legal challenge by homeowners living near the wind farm. So, always beware, behind any environmental cause, you're going to find the banksters, the gangsters, and the oil oligarchs. Milwaukee food relief line grows long and tense. This from JS Online. The chaos that erupted outside Milwaukee County's main welfare office over disaster-related food aid had more to do with a weak economy and crushing poverty in parts of this community than the devastating floods that swept through the state earlier in the month. About 3,000 people turned out for the assistance beginning at 3 a.m., creating a line that stretched several blocks around the Marsha P. Coggs Human Services Center. At least one woman said she was trampled when a crowd rushed the doors as they opened at about 7:30 a.m. and dozens of Milwaukee police officers and sheriff's deputies were called to quell the scene. a rare scene at the moment, but we shall see. Finally, in this nasty batch of EnviroHealth news, this from ABC Australia, the soil on Mars is good for asparagus. There's still no answer to the old question of whether there has ever been life on Mars, but apparently there could be vegetable life. NASA scientists say the soil they have collected from the northern polar regions of the Red Planet would be good for growing asparagus and turnips, but probably not strawberries. The Phoenix Mars lander scooped up soil with its robotic arm, and scientists say the sample is similar to dirt found in some backyards on Earth. The project's lead chemist, Samuel Kunaves from the University of Arizona, says he is flabbergasted by what has come back, saying, quote, "We basically have found what appears to be the requirements, the nutrients to support life, whether past, present, or future." Now, my man Lee Rogers at RogueGovernment.com has been doing a lot of work on the Phoenix Mars lander and all the interesting questions surrounding it and the photos and what they're really doing and what they're really finding. Back to 9/11, back to the presidential selection. I posted this up just yesterday. McCain was asked about PNAC and 9/11 at a town hall meeting. In Portsmouth, Ohio, John McCain was asked why he wasn't more supportive of the 9/11 victims.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you for giving us all the opportunity to come and, you know, ask some questions. And I was curious about a document back in September 2000, Project for a New American Century, or PNAC, whose members included Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Jeb Bush, and Paul Wolfowitz, wrote a document entitled Rebuilding America's Defenses. In it, they state, quote, "The process of transformation, even if it brings revolutionary change, is likely to be a long one, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor." Now, many Americans believe that that new Pearl Harbor event took place on 9/11. And according to a recent New York Times and CBS News poll, 84% of Americans believe that there were some criminal elements of our government involved in 9/11. Hold on. Can you tell us about your role as president of the New Citizen Project, founded in 1994, which served as a chief fundraising and parent organization to PNAC? And is this one of the factors that has made you so reluctant to support the victims' family members and first responders who are begging for a new investigation into 9/11? It's a serious question.
Well, I have a serious answer, sir, and that is that it was Joe Lieberman and I, a Democrat, that sponsored the legislation for the 9/11 Commission. And I'm proud of that. It was a bipartisan effort. And very frankly, the administration was not, enthusiastic about the establishment of that commission. We had some of those most respected men and women in America serve on that commission. Now, with every... Let me just put it this way. I am proud of what the 9/11 Commission did. I am proud that we have enacted many of the reforms, although not all, of the reforms that they recommended. And I will stand by their recommendations and their conclusions, as will the overwhelming majority of Americans. It's a free country. You are free to disagree with their conclusions, but I am proud to have been one of those who was, along with Joe Lieberman, responsible for the establishment of the 9/11 Commission. And I support their conclusions.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Now, I can't remember off the top of my head, and I can't see it, but that happened in Ohio. But actually, the guy who asked that question left a comment on the posting on MediaMonarchy.com. It was a We Are Change guy, maybe Colorado, and I'm sorry if I got that wrong. But either way, we salute you. Big balls standing up to John McInsane. And of course, he's well tied into the ongoing 9/11 cover-up, writing the foreword to the Popular Mechanics whitewash, and on and on. The other side of the WWF dog and pony show, the Democrats, yes, your precious Democrats, have sold you out yet again. Senate bows to Bush, approves surveillance bill. This from the AP. Bowing to President Bush's demands, the Senate approved and sent the White House a bill Wednesday to overhaul bitterly disputed rules on secret government eavesdropping and shield telecommunications companies from lawsuits complaining that they, you know, helped spy on Americans. If we jump to Ceylon, Congress votes to immunize law-breaking telecoms and legalize warrantless eavesdropping. The Democratic-led Congress this afternoon, that would be yesterday, voted to put an end to the NSA spying scandal as the Senate approved a bill approved last week by the House to immunize law-breaking telecoms, terminate all pending lawsuits against them, and vest whole new warrantless eavesdropping powers in the president. The vote in favor for the new FISA bill was 69-28. Barack Obama joined every Senate Republican and every House Republican other than one by voting in favor of it, while his now-vanquished primary rival, Senator Hillary Clinton, voted against it. John McCain wasn't present for any of the votes, but shared Obama's support for the bill. The bill will now be sent to an extremely happy George Bush, who already announced that he enthusiastically supports it and he will sign it into law very shortly. I believe one of the quotes is that he will relish it. So finally, the update. Bush signs the FISA bill and the ACLU sues. The American Civil Liberties Union filed suit Thursday over a controversial wiretapping law challenging the constitutionality of the expanded spy powers Congress granted to the president on Wednesday. The federal lawsuit was filed with the court just hours after Bush signed the bill into law. The ACLU is suing on behalf of journalists and human rights groups, asking the court to put a halt to Congress's legalization of Bush's formerly secret warrantless wiretapping program. The ACLU contends, with a link to their 40-some page PDF, the ACLU contends the expanded spying power violates the Constitution's prohibition on unreasonable searches and seizures.
Now, I'm not privy to, nor do I ever want to be privy to, the wildest dreams of George W. Bush. But I'm still willing to bet that 3 years ago, when we learned he was spying on Americans illegally, I'm betting that his wildest dreams did not include the prospect that Congress, a Democratic-led Congress, would help him cover up his crimes. Today, in our fourth story on the countdown, that is exactly what the U.S. Senate is poised to do tomorrow. In the Senate today, Democrats put forward three amendments to the FISA bill, a bill that would not only succumb to Mr. Bush's desire for greater legalized wiretapping, it would also block civil lawsuits against the telecoms, perhaps the best chance we will ever have to find out the extent of our own government's spying, illegal spying, on us. The bill would give telecoms immunity for any illegal wiretapping they did for the Bush administration, as long as that illegal wiretapping was authorized by the Bush administration. It's like letting a getaway car driver off the hook because the bank robber told him that robbing banks was legal. Today, a handful of Democrats pointed out how the bill gives the one-fingered salute to the rule of law.
I'm not out to get the telephone companies. I just want us to know who it was in the administration said, go break the law. The American people ought to know who in the White House said, go break the law. Who it was who made the decision that somehow this president stands above the law?
And on top of all this, we're considering granting immunity when roughly 70 members of the Senate still have not been briefed on the president's wiretapping program. The vast majority of this body still does not even know what we're being asked to grant immunity for.
Despite claiming the bill's wiretapping powers are essential to the nation's safety, President Bush yesterday threatened to veto the bill if Feingold and Leahy succeed in removing immunity for the telecoms. At the recommendation of Attorney General Michael Mukasey and others, Mr. Bush even said he will veto the bill if it includes a provision that would merely delay immunity and freeze the telecom lawsuits until after Congress had the opportunity to learn what actions by the telecoms and the government they would be immunizing. The vote on the bill, complete with immunity, is set for tomorrow. Most observers say that Leahy, Feingold, and other Democratic holdouts don't have a chance.
Today, the United States Congress passed a vital piece of legislation that will make it easier for this administration and future administrations to protect the American people. This vital intelligence bill will allow our national security professionals to quickly and effectively monitor the plans of terrorists outside the United States while respecting the liberties of the American people. This legislation is critical to America's safety. It is long overdue. Months ago, my administration set out key criteria that this intelligence legislation would have to have before I would sign it into law. the Attorney General and Director of National Intelligence report that the bill Congress passed today meets these criteria, and therefore I will soon sign the bill into law. This bill will help our intelligence professionals learn who the terrorists are talking to, what they're saying, and what they're planning. It'll ensure that those companies whose assistance is necessary to protect the country will themselves be protected from lawsuits for past or future cooperation with the government. It will uphold our most solemn obligation as officials of the federal government to protect the American people.
That was a little before and after. First part of the clip, you heard Rachel Maddow from the supposed left Air America, now with her General Electric Microsoft show on MSNBC, and then we heard King George. They sold you out. You're lumping and projecting a bunch of bullshit change onto Obama, and the election hasn't even happened, and he's already betraying it. So in that story, there are other links, you know, to articles such as Why Obama Just Lost My Vote, and on and on. But we're going to shift a little bit and get into a little bit of media here in the monarchy. This from The Hollywood Reporter. MGM to remake Red Dawn for a post-9/11 world. Red Dawn will be redone. Screenwriter Carl Ellsworth has been hired to recraft the ultimate homeland invasion story about a new generation of besieged high schoolers. The tone is going to be very intense, very much keeping in mind the post-9/11 world that we're in, says Ellsworth, who was 11 when the original was released. As Red Dawn scared the heck out of people in 1984, we feel that the world is kind of already filled with a lot of paranoia and unease. So why not scare the hell out of people again? The original Red Dawn was the Cold War brainchild of writer-director John Milius, M-I-L-I-U-S, who devised a World War III invasion of America by the Soviets and Cubans. The film followed the scrappy insurgency of a group of Midwestern teenagers who take on their high school mascot name, Wolverines, as a rallying cry of resistance. The 1984 action drama was the first film released in theaters with the newly devised PG-13 rating because of its intense subject matter and violent content. MGM, and we'll get to this at the end of the show, they did actually visit the page. Someone at MGM was Googling to see their coverage of their Red Dawn remake, and they landed on MediaMonarchy.com. But yet again, more predictive programming. And it's also just that they're completely bankrupt and devoid of new ideas, that they have to raid their vaults and remake movies they already hold the rights to. Jumping back to the AFP, newsflash, plants love higher CO2 levels. In other news, fish like water and people like oxygen. Stay tuned for more amazing scientific discoveries. From the AFP, the dangerous rise in greenhouse gases in the atmosphere may be troubling scientists and world leaders because they want to get their carbon tax passed. But it could prove to be a boon for plants, German researchers said Tuesday. Increasing exposure to carbon dioxide appears to boost crop yields, said the Johann Heinrich von Thunen Institute for Rural Areas, Forestry and Fisheries, with a link for you. They're in the central city of Brunswick. Output increased by about 10% for barley, beets, and wheat when the plants were subjected to higher levels of carbon dioxide. I'm not going to get into the global warming foo-for-all, argle-bargle. I got too much to get into, but you better do some research and see what's happening on Mars. If we jump over to the saber-rattling in Iran, they are testing missiles. Exactly why, we can't be sure. It would seem that with all eyes gazing their way, that they wouldn't want to do something provocative like this. But, again, is it just WWF on another scale? And we see reports already, you know, of Israeli and U.S. technology actually helping Iran with their fighter jets or their nuclear reactors or whatever it is. But let's hit up Danger Room. We're going to hit it up twice. Iran's mega missile test, and I add in Israel's paranoia. Iran's Revolutionary Guards fired off a slew of missiles in a military exercise, but of the weapons, there's one that U.S. and Israeli observers are examining with particular care. a 56-foot-long Shahab-3 missile with a reported range of 1,250 miles, far enough to hit Israeli soil, and American bases if it works as planned. The Shahab, or Meteor, is the Iranian version of the North Korean Nodong Night Watch, notes. I'm sorry, I jumbled that. Is the Iranian version of the North Korean Nodong. The Nodong can be well made, but its guidance system is quirky. A Pakistani Nodong, called the Gwari, which was launched from northeastern Pakistan, corkscrewed out of control and landed in southern Afghanistan once, instead of a downrange inside Pakistan. This goes on with a lot of technical talk. However, we'll jump to the update, which is the interesting and important part, because we know that just last month, Israel, they were doing a lot of war games. So if it's okay for Israel to do war games, isn't it okay for another sovereign nation like Iran to do war games? The update, though, from Danger Room, yet again, and it's making the rounds, and of course, like any meme that makes it out onto the web, there'll be remixes and parodies within hours, and so there's lots of photo mashups, Photoshop jobs of the photo that's up in this. Iran missile photo faked. Yesterday, bloggers like Gateway Pundit, Kamen Gear, Suitably Flip, and Little Green Footballs and more noticed something fishy about the picture Iran released of its mega missile launch. Some portions of the picture look to be retreads from earlier images. Plus, the pic showed four missiles, which turned out to be one too many. AFP, which spread the photo to the West, eventually retracted the pic for being, quote, apparently digitally altered. But it was too late for the Los Angeles Times and the Chicago Tribune, which had already ran the image on page one. Ditto BBC, MSNBC, Yahoo News, New York Times, and many other major news websites. And by the way, Iran launched another missile salvo yesterday. So, whose propaganda is who? Is life imitating art, or vice versa? We're going to find out. Returning to a good bit of our recurring theme of amazing Fox propaganda, many believe the world will end in 2012. Fox reports that there are thousands and thousands of people who believe that there's a gathering storm that will result in the end of the world in the year 2012.
What are you going to dog pimp?
Right. Is anything going to happen in 2012 that I should worry about, Alice?
Well, Judge, apparently thousands and thousands of people believe that the world is going to end 4 years from now in the year 20. Well, don't panic yet, everyone.
Yeah. Was that
in 2012, yes, our producers are screaming in the green room. And this is based on a few different things. First of all, the Mayan calendar basically predicts that the world will end in 2012.
Oh, we'll take a look right there. There it is, graphically.
It's obvious. Right. It plays
in the day, ladies and gentlemen.
Can you explain and interpret that?
Yes.
Steve?
No.
Not only that, the ancient Egyptians also see the year 2012 as a very critical pivotal year. By the way, so does NASA.
Right.
NASA.
At home, yes, our modern-day NASA predicts that there's going to be all sorts of astronomical activity, more sunspots, asteroids, all meteors, all that stuff in the year 2012.
Should Steve and I be worried?
I think so.
No.
I do.
Can I get a deal? Am I going to have to call LegalZoom.com? Here's the thing. They made these calendars a long time ago. And so because they've never really updated the Mayan calendar, they figure, well, they knew something back in the day when they were carving that thing out, so something must be up. But there are a bunch of survivalists who, and in fact, we read a report this morning about one particular guy. He had a good job. He quit his job. Now he's moved out in the mountains, and he's quit his job because he figures he's got enough money to survive until 2012, got enough water, and he's ready to ride out the apocalypse.
Oh, boy.
But it's not just a handful of people. I mean, we should say
there's
a gathering storm, they believe. Yes. So we'll keep an eye on that developing storm.
Walk it off.
Speaking of storms.
So there are our good friends at Fox with their retarded sound effects like their morning shock jocks, talking about something they have very little clue of. I don't believe the Mayan calendar says the world's going to end. There's going to be a shift. And we know there's going to be a shift, Mayan calendar or not. There's a great new article from the amazing Peter Dale Scott. It's quite a lengthy one, and what I always love about folks like Peter Dale Scott is it is amazingly footnoted and documented. There are dozens and dozens and dozens of footnotes. We're only going to hit the first few paragraphs, but it's an important one, and I always like to shine a light on anything that compares and contrasts JFK, 9/11, and the designated suspects in both. So this is Peter Dale Scott. I wish to summarize again the first striking similarity between 11/22/63 and 9/11/01, the dubious detective work on those 2 days. Less than 15 minutes after the president's assassination, the height and weight of Kennedy's alleged killer was posted. Before the last of the hijacked planes crashed on 9/11, the FBI told Richard Clark that they had a list of the alleged hijackers. In the case of Oswald, within 15 minutes of the assassination and long before Oswald was picked up in the Texas theater, Inspector Sawyer of the Dallas Police put out on the radio and possibly other networks a description of the killer, about 30, 5'10", 165 pounds. As noted, this height and weight exactly matched the measurements attributed to Lee Harvey Oswald in Oswald's FBI file and also in CIA documents about him. The announced height and weight were, however, different from Oswald's actual measurements as recorded by the Dallas police after his arrest, 5'9½", 130 pounds. More importantly, there is no credible source for the posted measurements from any witness in Dallas. The witness said to have spotted him, Howard Brennan, failed to identify Oswald in a lineup. This leaves the possibility that the measurements were taken from existing files on Oswald rather than from any observations in Dallas on November 22nd. If so, someone with access to those files may have already designated Oswald as the culprit before there was any evidence to connect him to the crime. And I'll just mention as the sidebar that Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty, while in Christchurch, I believe New Zealand, he picked up a newspaper over there. It was already, of course, the next day. But timing-wise, it was just an hour or two after the assassination, but they already had the photos and everything. Back to the article. A similar situation pertains to the alleged hijackers on 9/11. For example, shortly afterwards, men in Saudi Arabia complained that the hijackers' personal details released by the FBI, including name, place, date of birth, and occupation, matched their own. One of them, Saeed Al-Ghamdi, claimed further that an alleged photograph shown on CNN of an alleged Flight 93 hijacker with the same name was in fact a photograph of himself. He speculated, quote, that CNN had probably got the picture from the flight safety flying school he attended in Florida. If the above information is accurate, then the details posted by the FBI and CNN about the alleged hijackers cannot have been derived from the events of 9/11, with which the survivors in Saudi Arabia would appear to have been uninvolved. Once again, this leaves the strong possibility that the details were taken from existing files rather than from empirical observations on 9/11. And some of the hijackers, like Lee Harvey Oswald, may have been in CIA files for a special reason, because the CIA had an operational interest in them. That article goes on, and I implore you to check it out, from Peter Dale Scott, JFK, 9/11, and the designated suspects in both cases. Back into 9/11, the BBC hit piece, more on Building 7, the debris, the remains, it goes on and on and on. The BBC released their latest hit piece on their conspiracy file show, The Third Tower. And I'm not going to even play any clips from it. It's struggling. And we've hit some of it before, Barry Jennings and all that, and we of course mentioned Jerome Howard at the top of the show. But from RogueGovernment.com, the BBC, which just recently aired a hit piece on people asking questions about the events of 9/11, also posted an editorial by Mike Rudin on their website attempting again to rationalize how they managed to report that Building 7 had collapsed before the building actually fell. Now, remember Jane Stanley in New York reported to the BBC that Building 7 had fallen and it's standing behind her? This is just one aspect of the BBC engaging in an incredible amount of deception. As hard as this might be to believe, this is nothing compared to the insane amount of lies and deceit that is packaged in the new documentary, The Third Tower, that attempts to prove the insanest conspiracy theory of all, that WTC-7 was brought down due to fire damage. And so the link is there. You can watch the entire Third Tower. But speaking of BBC, let's jump to them for a different 9/11 story. Judge kills lawsuit to move WTC dust from fresh kills. A U.S. judge has dismissed a legal case claiming that the New York authorities denied proper burials to the victims on 9/11. Relatives of World Trade Center victims claimed that the city acted wrongly by sending debris that might have held remains to a rubbish dump called Fresh Kills. The lawsuit asked for the debris to be removed to land that could be turned into a cemetery, but the judge said the families had no claim to the removed material. We hit up 911blogger.com, quote, "Shockingly calm. Phone calls from the planes on 9/11. This is also another lengthy article with copious footnotes. A number of people received phone calls the morning of 9/11 that they believe were made by individuals on board the planes that crashed in New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania. Descriptions of these calls, however, reveal something odd. According to the official story, we've been told the callers were in an unprecedented crisis, stuck on planes under the control of murderous terrorists and with no knowledge of whether they were going to be allowed to live or die. Yet in many of the phone calls, the caller appears to have been remarkably calm. Perhaps if just a few of them, for example, those with specific personal experiences like the flight attendant who was a former police officer, had maintained their composure, then this would be less remarkable. Yet, the majority of the callers displayed this same calmness. In their recollection, some of the people who received the calls have indeed commented on this fact, apparently surprised by it. Some of them have also commented on the absence of panic, screaming, or other sounds of chaos in the background." And again, that's a lengthy article, lots of footnotes, "Shockingly calm, phone calls from the planes on 9/11. Jumping now to Under the Radar. UndertheRadarMedia.blogspot.com. Urban Moving Systems, U.S.-Israeli 9/11 Financial Nexus. With a global awakening of what really happened on 9/11 surging ahead at full steam, many people are now aware of the facts such as prior government knowledge of the attacks, the mysterious collapse of Building 7, the terror drills, and on and on and on. What is not known by the majority of these people, but is equally important as Building 7, is the story of Urban Moving Systems. And so there's links there you can read about Urban Moving Systems. The short version is basically they were an Israeli company who broke their lease, ate thousands and thousands of dollars to get out of the World Trade Center before 9/11, basically about 2 weeks before. And the connections, like I said, are dubious. We also have an article from the one and only Jerry Mazza up on onlinejournal.com, "What to Do with Ground Zero." In light of the fact that we are 2 months and 11 days shy of the 7th anniversary of 9/11, America's greatest homeland attack, and that the New York Times reported in its City Room blog, higher costs and delays expected at Ground Zero. And of course, the reported rebuilding at 9/11 site runs late. I would suggest you first read those articles, then click on Wikipedia's World Trade Center site. The latter will give you a brief history of the real estate boondoggle that has left the 16-acre site with construction stops and starts. There's a 36-page PDF by the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey about what went wrong, and the bottom line that the memorial to the loss of 9/11 will not be open on time for the 10th anniversary, that's September 11th, 2011, as previously announced. And we're going to get more into that later in the show. We're now into hour number two of episode 83 at 7/11/2008. My name's James Evan Pilato, your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com, coming to you from the Portland Radio Authority, PRARadio.org, and the Revere Radio Network, RevereRadio.info. One more bit of 9/11 news. 9/11 Chronicles, Part 1, Truth Rising, is out and about. It was released 1 week ago today. It's Alex Jones's latest documentary. I have not actually watched it yet, although I've heard some say that it brought a tear to their eyes. If we jump to Scoop out of New Zealand, and this, I believe, has already taken place, thank God. Simulated nuclear accident to be staged in Mexico. The United Nations Nuclear Watchdog Agency is to stage a simulated accident at a nuclear plant in Mexico to test emergency response systems. Some 74 member states of the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, as well as 10 international organizations, will be participating in the 48-hour drill at Mexico's Laguna Verde nuclear power plant, with a link for you. The UN World Health Organization, WHO, will also be taking part in the exercise to test its capabilities in a public health risk detection, assessment, and response, and its effectiveness in coordinating with other international agencies. And again, I always got to tell you, we pay attention to the drills, because they have been known to, amazingly, against all human odds, that sometimes the exact same things that are happening in the drill happen live, like on 7-7, which of course we also just had the anniversary of just a few days ago, and we're going to get to that as well. Right now, one of my favorite online news shows is called Collateral News. There's been a few episodes that I haven't been able to hit in the last couple weeks. We have episode 47, 48, and 49. We're only going to play the clip from Collateral News, episode 49. Do as you're told. Obey. July 4th was Independence Day, but just how much independence do you have from the most powerful social force there is? This week, Collateral News number 49 takes a look at one of the most controversial psychological experiments of the 20th century and asks the question, do you have what it takes to resist a malignant authority?
Remember the Milgram studies of the 1960s? They're back in the news just in time for Independence Day. They're an excellent reminder of the strongest social impulse, the impulse to obey authority. Welcome to Collateral.
All right, teacher, would you take the test and be seated in front of the shock generator, please, in the next room? This machine generates electric shocks. When you press one of the switches all the way down, the learner gets a shock. For example, in the first line, you read blue, boy, girl, grass, hat. Now, after you've read the four choices, the learner pushes one of the switches on the board in front of him, and the number he has selected will light up in this box, 1, 2, 3, or 4. If he were to indicate the wrong answer, you would say wrong. Then tell him the number of volts you're going to give him. Then give him a punishment. Now, each time he gets a wrong answer, you move up one switch on the shock generator.
In July of 1961, 3 months after the start of the trial of Nazi war criminal Adolf Eichmann, Stanley Milgram conducted arguably the most well-known and controversial public experiments of the 20th century. His topic, the dynamics of obedience. Specifically, Milgram sought to determine whether ordinary people would obey instructions that resulted in the injury of another person because those instructions came from an authority figure.
I mean, who's going to take the responsibility if anything happens to that gentleman?
I'm responsible for anything that happens here. Continually.
There's a lot of them here. You know, you have a heart condition there. You want me to go?
Just continue, please.
Many people believe that Milgram's findings can't be applied to our time, since allegedly people are more distrustful of authority. But recent studies have shown that to be false. The British Channel 4, for just one example, recently replicated core elements of the Milgram study in 2006. The results were virtually identical.
Incorrect. 450 volts. You promise he's not. They won't.
Please continue with the procedure.
You say it hurts, but it's because it's like it says they're dangerous initial. It'll be all right. Yeah.
Please continue. Okay, I think we'll just continue the experiment.
It's important to remember that Milgram did not expect the results that his experiments delivered. Contrary to expectation, it was found that almost two-thirds of those tested were willing to administer and continue administering what they believed were extremely painful shocks right up to the 450-volt threshold. This despite loud screams coming from the learner. Milgram then refined the study in a number of ways to gain information about the variables that affect obedience, like proximity and modeling behavior. In one version, the experimenter phoned in the orders from another building, and obedience went down considerably. In another version, the learners were brought into the same room as the teachers, and obedience went down again. Perhaps most importantly, Milgram found that resistance breeds resistance. In studies where multiple teachers were tested simultaneously, one teacher disobeying the experimenter made it more likely that others would follow suit.
But the experiment requires you to continue.
Yeah, even so, I don't think I'm going to do any more.
Because of the problem from generalizing from the lab to the real world, Milgram's findings will always remain somewhat controversial. But it's clear that under fairly definable circumstances, ordinary people can readily become cops in an evil process.
Just any response, mate. Come on. Wild guess.
Please continue.
345 volts, if you're still with me. I'm sorry.
The impulse to obey is so powerful that it overrides moral teaching. Even more disturbingly, those who behave worst are more likely to deny responsibility for their actions, preferring to believe it was the experimenter's orders that were responsible for what they did.
450 volts.
450 volts.
450.
Beyond the dynamics of obedience, the experiment should also get us thinking about the concept of identification. Before the study began, the experimenters treated the teachers as important participants in a study benefiting science. No doubt this helped with the positive identification the teachers had with the experimenters. Most of us can relate. After all, why do presidential candidates spend so much time shaking hands? Because the one-to-one contact makes the person on the other end of the handshake feel important. We should remember the effects of this kind of identification at a time when the corporate media spends a disproportionate amount of time on the personal characteristics of presidents and candidates. And they're presented less as political leaders than they are as mildly annoying family friends or visitors to our living rooms. The media will ask questions like, which one would you rather have a beer with? Who cares? Positive and personal identification with the authority figure was critical in the Milgram studies. Today, that same identification makes it hard for many people to accept that our country's leaders have betrayed us. When our leaders use noble-sounding language and speak of a desire to protect the nation, we identify with that. But when their true motives and all their ugliness become obvious, well, as Milgram put it, few people have the resources needed to resist authority. Hope to see you next week.
If in this study, an anonymous experimenter could successfully command adults to subdue a 50-year-old man and force on him painful electric shocks against his protests, one can only wonder what government, with its vastly greater authority and prestige, can command of its subjects.
That was episode 49 of Collateral News. Do as you're told, and the Stanley Milgram experiments. Now we're going to shift gears and we're going to come back home to Portland, Oregon. It's another positive drug story. This from our own K2 News. Oregon initiative would allow pot sales in liquor stores.
Relax it and tax it. That's the motto behind a new cannabis initiative that would allow liquor stores to sell marijuana. 90% of the proceeds from the state sale of marijuana would go to the Oregon General Fund, lowering Oregonians' tax burdens. That's what supporters say. Smaller percentages would go to drug abuse education and treatment. Supporters say allowing the state liquor store to sell pot would add $300 million in combined tax revenues and savings.
We want to take marijuana out of the hands of the children and substance abusers who control the market today and put it in the state Liquor Control Commission's hands, where the age limit of 21 will be strictly enforced.
Supporters have 2 years to collect nearly 83,000 signatures to get this on the November ballot in 2010.
There you go. And if our own Liquor Commission, the OLCC, if anybody can do it, it would probably be them. So we'll see. 2010. Another clip, another disgusting expose and proof that we are torturing people. This video's up, and it's General Taguba, not Tagumbu, but General T-A-G-U-B-A. Bush and the neocons are guilty of war crimes.
Well, Karen, this report really has some very disturbing details in it. As you say, medical evaluations conducted on 11 former detainees at both Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq and Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, men who were never charged with crimes. This 121-page report from the group Physicians from Human Rights Indeed says it found evidence of beatings, electrical shock, sleep deprivation, sexual humiliation, and sodomy. Dr. Alan Keller, who was one of the evaluators on the study, spoke a little earlier today.
We found clear physical and psychological evidence of torture and abuse, often causing lasting suffering, whether it was scars from brutal beatings or nightmares of sexual humiliations that they endured.
Karen, one of the underpinnings of this report is that the foreword, the preface to the report, was written by retired Major General Anthony Chiguba. He led the Army's investigation into the abuses at Abu Ghraib prison. He is one of the most respected senior officers in the Army, now retired, and he said in that preface, quote, "There is no longer any doubt that the current administration committed war crimes." That's a very serious statement from a very respected retired officer. The Pentagon has not directly addressed this report, but has continued to say over the years that detainees are treated humanely and that any abuses were isolated incidents that were dealt with. Karen?
So where does it go from here? What is the possibility that there will be repercussions from this report?
Well, it's hard to say. There have been investigations. The Pentagon's position is there have been multiple investigations of the situation at Abu Ghraib, at Guantanamo Bay. We saw extended hearings on Capitol Hill yesterday into these techniques of interrogation that many people are now increasingly calling torture. A lot of groups want people held accountable, but other than some low-level soldiers who were at Abu Ghraib in Iraq several years ago, no senior officers, no senior commanders have ever been held accountable.
Just the underlings who were doing what they were told to do. Torture. In my name, in your name, in all of our names. Another clip, another monstrosity. Provocateur anarchist planning to crash the RNC convention. We've hit this before. We've mentioned one of their names, Recreate 68. But this comes from Raw Replay. Fox's Jamie Reese reported that anarchists have made radio announcements about their plans to crash the Republican convention in Minnesota. So we have a clip from, yet again, more masterful propaganda from Fox's America's Newsroom from July 7th. Then there's another one. Fox host predicts GOP mayhem at the Democratic convention. And there's also a third story, I believe, from CNN. Top secret weapons to be used at political conventions. CNN's Ed Lavandera reported, the Congress is giving $100 million to pay the security expenses for this summer's political conventions. Denver and St. Paul officials have said that the types of weapons being purchased are, quote, top secret. And you can hit up Democracy Now! For more on that. The ACLU is suing both cities to disclose how security money is being spent. Well, we can probably guess that it's on pain rays and sound wave cannons. So, let's listen to all this propaganda. It's a big shit sandwich. Two Fox clips with a CNN in between.
All right, now over the top of Invesco Field out in the Rocky Mountain city of Denver. Is there a lid? Because they might need it, because Barack Obama has announced that he's not going to go ahead and accept his party's nomination out in Denver during the DNC in the Pepsi Center, where everybody, including a lot of TV executives, had planned on it and made logistical reservations and schedules. Instead, he's going to do it in a much bigger place. That stadium right there, with no lid, Invesco Field, is going to be a big rock star moment, his campaign says, for Barack Obama.
Now, your fellow meteorologists say that on that day in August in Denver, there's a 30% chance of rain. What will they do? There's 86,000 people there and the whole world watching, and it rains. The other issue is, when you...
When JFK spoke in L.A., the place was only two-thirds filled. These guys have to pack this place.
Right.
Because if they don't, it's going to be a letdown. They're already advertising, as you say, more than 80,000 people.
Right, but the big question is, of course, if there are a bunch of people with John McCain signs out there, will the mainstream media even show those dissenters?
There you go.
Probably not.
Well, anarchists are hitting the airwaves in the Midwest. They call themselves the RNC Welcoming Committee, and they have plans to crash the Republican convention in Minnesota later this summer. Fox's Jamie Reese from station KMSP has that story for us.
You are listening to Share Community Radio.
On independent radio station KFAI, Community Access Hour called the Wave Project featured a group determined to make waves.
The Welcoming Committee is an anarchist, anti-authoritarian organizing body preparing for the Republican National Convention.
Until now, what was known about the ironically named RNC Welcoming Committee came from its website.
We think that we have a responsibility to stand up.
Around microphones, a studio like this one, three members identified only as Harold, Emma, and Tony explained their plans to crash the convention.
We're not trying to influence the Republicans. They already know that people are against the war, people are against pollution and global warming and racism. The Republicans just don't seem to care.
Unlike other protests planning to march on the Xcel Energy Center, the Welcoming Committee wants to cut off the arena from delegates.
We don't think that the political elite will stop because we ask nicely, and so we advocate a strategy of direct action, in this case, not letting them hold the convention.
Last week, Fox 9 reported how the group had obtained shuttle routes and other transportation information as part of their strategy to set up blockades.
All that means is you're going to stay in an intersection or in a place, and you're not going to leave when the police tell you to leave.
Nearby business owners say they're thinking about the customers the convention will bring, not the chaos, and have no plans to board up their windows. The RNC Welcoming Committee says property destruction is not part of their plans, but they wouldn't rule it out either.
People attending the RNC are people who work for weapons manufacturers, drug companies, some of the banks responsible for all these housing foreclosures, not to mention the war criminals from Washington, D.C. themselves. These aren't nice people.
With 57 days until the convention, they signed off with this.
And we'll see you in the streets.
And that was Fox's Jamie Reese out in Minnesota.
Pepperball rifles, goo guns, and sonic rays. Some of them are just wild rumors, but some may not be. Some of those weapons might be used to protect our political conventions later on this year. Ed Lavandera is at the convention site in Denver where the Democrats are going to meet in August, and he's got more on this for us. Ed?
John and Kieran, to prepare for this summer's political conventions, Congress is giving the host cities, Denver and St. Paul, Minnesota, $50 million each to pay for security expenses. But what exactly that money is being spent on is top secret here in Denver.
$25 million buys a lot of very interesting things.
Bob Newman is an anti-terrorism consultant helping some Denver companies prepare for the Democratic convention. He's anxious to see what kind of crowd control weaponry authorities will deploy for the conventions.
There are also these crazy rumors going around.
City officials and the police department won't talk about most of the weapons in the...
This pepper rounds.
Okay. But they have confirmed one report that several $100,000 worth of high-powered pepper ball rifles will be used to disperse crowds.
So when that hits, the ball breaks, powder expels. The same exact reaction as pepper spray, except it's powder.
Congressional testimony revealed there will also be specialized gas detection equipment and biohazard equipment. Then there are the science fiction-like weapons that may or may not be part of the arsenal, like the goo gun.
It shoots almost like a rubbery gelatinous mass that when it strikes the body and it comes out in a continual stream, it wraps around limbs and wraps around the torso, and the person can't move.
It can also make a Humvee spin in place. Then there are the weapons that would make unruly crowds run for cover, like a sonic ray gun, a device which emits an ear-piercing sound, and a microwave device that can be focused on an area and make you feel like your skin is on fire. The ACLU has sued the city of Denver to find out if these weapons are in the arsenal.
Instead of asking the public, how come you want to know, maybe the question should be posed to the government, why are you so interested in keeping this secret?
Rational people are not concerned, but we know who is concerned, and those are the ones who will be causing the problems.
In Minnesota, where Republicans are holding their convention, the ACLU says it's also trying to find out how the security money is being spent. But law enforcement agencies insist these weapons should be kept secret so that they have the upper hand in keeping the convention safe.
John and Kieran, back to you.
Ed Lavendera reporting from Denver. The convention is going to have a huge impact on the city. Here's a look at an AM Extra. At least 35,000 people expected in Denver. 15,000 of them will be media covering the event. The party says 21,000 people have signed up as volunteers. And the city says the convention could bring in up to $200 million.
Cops to use top secret weapons on activists during the conventions. This from Kurt Nemo. In other words, members of both factions of the globalist political party will be safe from agents provocateurs who are routinely dispatched to break a few windows and burn trash in the street in order to give the cops an excuse to attack peaceful demonstrators. CNN and the corporate media are notorious for ignoring this fact, going back at least to late 99 during the WTO demonstrations in Seattle. Neil DeMause, D-E-M-A-U-S-E, wrote for FAIR in early 2000, quote, "Most news outlets ignored the police assaults that preceded the looting, preferring to believe that it was the acts of a few out-of-control protesters that led to the violence and downplaying police use of force. Numerous eyewitness reports would describe police ignoring vandals while busily assaulting demonstrators who were blockading the entrance to WTO. The Seattle Times, in its timeline of the WTO protest, 12-5-99, noted the first use of pepper spray and rubber bullets on demonstrators at 10 a.m. on November 30th, nearly 2 hours before the first windows were broken. Peter Cassidy, a police tactics researcher, said at the time that the lack of concern over Seattle police behavior will lend credibility for other police departments to do the same. In short, opening your mouth becomes something that exposes you to danger. It exposes you to militarized forms of law enforcement." We're going to need a lot of people with a lot of eyes to keep eyes peeled on the conventions, which I think are going to be ugly, to say the very least. The Olympics, which is a powder keg waiting to go off. Your bank that may be ready to, if it's not going to close itself, maybe it's going to foreclose on your home and food and weather, and more, and more, and more. But if we jump back to the BBC, we mentioned, of course, 7/7, the London bombings, of course, the drills that were going on of the exact same trains and buses in the exact same times and places exploding just like they were in the drill. Peter Power and Visor Consultants. Anniversary ceremony remembers victims of 7/7. Hundreds of people crowded into King's Cross Station to remember the 52 people killed in the 7/7 suicide bombings in London 3 years ago. Minister for London Tessa Jowell and London Mayor Boris Johnson laid flowers there at 8:50 British Standard Time, the time the first three bombs exploded. Also from the Collège Times, how 7/7 changed Britain. On the eve of the third anniversary of the 7/7 bombings, Channel 4's Dispatches, with a link for you, returns to one of its favorite subjects, Muslims. The program, called It Shouldn't Happen to a Muslim, looks at how life has changed for Muslim families in the UK since 9/11. It recounts vicious stories of horrific racist brutality against Muslims, not the extremist ones, but the ordinary law-abiding ones, stories that are rarely reported in the press. And of course, 9/11 affected them, and 7/7 affected us, as well as the big phony liquid terror plot. But let's get a little bit of good news, a little bit of fun news. Our man, Sacha Baron Cohen, Borat. Sacha Baron Cohen dupes Israeli intelligence. This from ITN. A former Mossad official said he was the target of the latest undercover operation by British comedian Sacha Baron Cohen. Analyst Yossi Alfer was invited to be interviewed for what was supposed to be a documentary on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Said he realized something was amiss when he saw the interviewer, a man claiming to be a German rock star dressed in leather and studs, who compared the Middle East conflict to the spat between actor Brad Pitt's former and current wives. Due to the sheer inanity of the questions, Mr. Alfer and his Palestinian counterpart began to suspect the interview was a scam, but it was too late to pull out as the two had signed release forms and received payment for the interview. In answering one question, the interviewees had to explain the difference between Hamas, an Islamic group ruling Gaza, and hummus, a chickpea paste eaten throughout the region. Again from Paul Joseph Watson, but more brutal news. Afghanistan accuses Foreign Intelligence Agency of the bombing that just took place a few days ago in Afghanistan. Afghanistan's interior minister has accused a, quote, foreign intelligence agency with a link to voanews.com for you, of being behind the deadly suicide bombing that ripped apart the country's Indian embassy in Kabul, killing 41 people. Could the event represent another false flag run by American intelligence as a means of maintaining a military presence in Afghanistan and control the country's lucrative opium trade? The Interior Ministry believes this attack was carried out in coordination and consultation with an active intelligence service in the region, the ministry said in a statement. That article goes on, but let's listen to a little bit of Associated Press whitewash.
40 people are dead after a car bomb tore through the front wall of India's embassy in Afghanistan's capital city. It's the deadliest attack in Kabul since the fall of the Taliban. Indian officials say their defense attaché and a diplomat were among the four Indians killed in the suicide bombing.
The government of India strongly condemns this cowardly terrorist attack on its diplomatic mission in Afghanistan.
Earlier reports put the number of people injured at 141. The embassy is located near the city center. Nearby shops were destroyed or damaged. The explosion itself rattled much of Kabul. One witness says he heard the explosion, then was covered in dust. He says he then saw dead bodies everywhere. The blast happened at the embassy's gate, where many Afghans line up each morning to apply for visas. An Afghan official says the bomber was inside the car when he blew it up. Afghanistan has seen a sharp rise in violence from Taliban militants in recent months. Insurgents are packing bombs with more explosives than ever. That's one reason why more U.S. and NATO troops were killed in June than any month since the 2001 invasion. While Afghanistan has seen increasing violence, Kabul had largely been spared from the bomb attacks. Matt Friedman, The Associated Press.
And of course, we see that we're getting an Afghan surge. The attention has shifted back to Afghanistan. We, of course, need to guard those poppies. But let's jump to the Deal Book blog on the New York Times. This ties into, of course, the climate calamities and the impending carbon tax and carbon credits and carbon footprints in your ass. Banksters team up to buy the Weather Channel. An investor group led by NBC Universal, so that's General Electric right there, and Universal, and two private equity firms clinched a deal for the Weather Channel last Sunday after 3 weeks of negotiation over the sale of the weather news giant. Though the parties did not disclose the price, the buyers, NBC, and the private equity firms Bain Capital, who we know, of course, Mitt Romney is a huge player in, and also the Blackstone Group, with a link to SourceWatch so you can read about Blackstone, will pay just under $3.5 billion. Others financing the deal are Deutsche Bank, our good friends with Buzzy Krongard and pre-9/11 insider trading, which was also the buyer's lead financial advisor, and General Electric's GE Commercial Finance Unit. J.P. Morgan Chase worked as Landmark's financial advisor, while Wilcox, Savage, Kilpatrick, Stockton, Venable, and Skadden, Arps, Slate, Meager, and Flom provided legal service. Skadden, Arps, you can learn more about from Richard Andrew Grove and 8thestate.com. But there you go. The banksters seizing control of the Weather Channel, and they'll be sure to tell you all about your carbon footprint. If we jump to the AP, this dovetails with something I don't have posted up yet, and that's, I believe, toxic materials from Kuwait going to Idaho. However, what we do have is uranium shipped to Canada from Iraq in a secret mission. The last major remnant of Saddam Hussein's nuclear program, a huge stockpile of concentrated natural uranium, reached Montreal last Saturday to complete a top-secret U.S. mission. The removal of 550 metric tons of yellow cake. The seed material for higher-grade nuclear enrichment included a two-week airlift from Baghdad and a voyage across two oceans. The Iraqi government sold the yellow cake to a Canadian uranium producer, Cameco Corp, with links for you, in a transaction the official described as worth tens of millions of dollars. A Cameco spokesman, Lyle Cran, said the yellow cake will be processed at facilities in Ontario for use in energy-producing reactors. We are pleased that we have taken the yellow cake from a volatile region into a stable area to produce clean electricity, Cran said. U.S. and Iraqi forces have guarded the 9,300-hectare Yellowcake site since its discovery. Another AP report on our dying, dying dollar. The buck doesn't stop here. It just keeps falling. The almighty dollar is almighty no more. It's been declining steadily for 6 years against other major currencies, undercutting its role as the leading international banking currency. The long slide is fanning inflation at home and playing a major role in the run-up of oil and gasoline prices everywhere. They're not exactly saying it. They're sort of tiptoeing around the issue. Food and gas are so expensive is because the dollar isn't worth shit. Everything made in America, which, of course, isn't all that much, from goods to entire companies, is near dirt cheap to many foreigners. Meanwhile, American consumers, both those who travel and those who stay at home, are seeing big price increases in energy, food, and imported goods. The dollar has lost roughly a quarter of its purchasing power against the currencies of major U.S. trading partners from its peak in 2002. And it's, of course, much worse than that. If we return to the military-industrial complex blog known as Danger Room on Wired.com, the microwave scream inside your skull. We've hit on this before. It's been referred to as audio spotlight, but basically sound can be beamed into your head. The U.S. military bankrolled early development of a non-lethal microwave weapon that creates sound inside your head. But in the end, the gadget may be just as likely to wind up in shopping malls as on battlefields. Reported in The New Scientist, with a link for you. The project is known as MEDUSA, a contrived acronym for Mob Excess Deterrent Using Silent Audio. The effect has long been laboratory curiosity with no application, but over the years the military has been intrigued, with a link for you. The idea, dubbed the telepathic ray gun, was mentioned in a 1998 U.S. Army study, link, which turned up in a recent Freedom of Information Act document dump. 5 years later, the Navy decided to put some R&D dollars into the project. The directional beam could be used for targeted messages, such as in-store promotions. And this is all a notion also spotted with another link for you to the U.S. Army's voice-to-skull idea. So when you put beaming sound into your head, and when you put beaming holographic deities up in the sky, you know, to make opposing armies think that Allah has returned and make them surrender, or to make Christians think that Jesus has returned. Lee Rogers has been hitting on this. I find it eminently interesting. Project Blue Beam and the fake rapture. Frank Lordy made a great video about it over at salvationrevelation.com. I played some of that for you several weeks ago. So if Orson Welles, with, you know, a little bit of think tank help behind him, could pull off War of the Worlds in 1938, what makes you think they won't be able to pull off a huge event in 2008? With CNN and Fox and YouTube and MySpace and Twitter and everything, will it be aliens? Will it be Jesus? Will it be Krishna? God knows. But let's jump over to Germany, shall we? I posted up a couple videos. The story comes from Simpatico. The Headless Hitler at a German wax museum.
German police say a man has ripped off the head of a wax figure of Adolf Hitler. The statue is located in Berlin's newly opened Madame Tussauds Wax Museum. The statue's presence in the museum has been recently criticized in German media. It's one of the many historical figures portrayed at Madame Tussauds.
Long lines at the grand opening of Madame Tussauds in Berlin, but police say visit number two didn't come for the sightseeing.
One man, 41 years old, a Berliner, came to this exhibition and he went to the wax figure of Adolf Hitler and then he attacked this wax figure and he threw the head from this wax figure down.
In protest, say police, at the fact that there was a figure of Hitler on display at all.
This is the spot where the figure of Hitler sat earlier this morning, intact, then shortly after 10, headless, and now removed altogether.
Here's how he looked at the media opening last Thursday. Then, a spokeswoman for Madame Tussauds explained that there were strict rules around the display.
video überwacht.
It is covered by video cameras with security personnel to make sure that nobody touched the figure or takes pictures of it.
Photos forbidden because of Germany's strict rules against the reproduction of Nazi images. But visitors we spoke to say Hitler belongs in the exhibition.
Although it's a controversy figure, and it's history, we can't deny it.
As sad as it all was, and as much as it can't ever be allowed to happen again, unfortunately it's part of history and so should be allowed to stay.
As for the suspect, he remains in police custody, possibly the only plotter against Hitler who managed to pull it off. Diana Magne, CNN, Berlin.
And of course, it's always just a hop, skip, and a jump from Adolf Hitler and Nazi Germany to the Bush family and 4th of July. And our good friend George W. Bush, in a rare bit of confrontation, had a little bit of trouble at Monticello.
Thank you, and happy 4th of July. I'm thrilled to be here at Monticello. I've never been here before. Citizens to be, we believe in free speech in the United States of America. And this is a fitting place to celebrate our nation's independence. Thomas Jefferson once said he'd rather celebrate the 4th of July than his own birthday. Appreciate you being here. Lieutenant Governor Bill Boley, Lieutenant Governor of the State of Virginia. Attorney General Bob McDonnell of the State of Virginia is with us. And all local officials, the world ruled by kings. Today we know history had other plans. There were many and equal. The God-given right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
You gotta love it while he's talking about, repressive kings. But a nice moment. And so, hat tip to David Swanson at AfterDowningStreet.org, as well as some of the other folks like Gail Murphy, Desiree Farouz, and Linda Lisanti. So hopefully that's just the first of more confrontations. Here's something scary, my friends. That was just the last week's bit of news. Now, with the last less than 20 minutes, I'm going to do my best to slam through all the bit of news that I didn't get to go through last week with Warren in the studio. I'm going to have to cut some of the clips, but here we go. First, from the First Post, we've got Aldo Moro and the Red Scare. 30 years ago, last Sunday, the Italian statesman Aldo Moro, A-L-D-O-M-O-R-O, was seized by the Red Brigades, and 8 weeks later, his body was dumped in downtown Rome. It was the most spectacular assassination by the Red Brigades and the most significant killing of a leader in Europe during the entire Cold War. But was this just the notoriously incompetent Red Brigades acting alone? Or did they have professional help from outside, particularly from senior NATO allies, worried that Italy was about to get a communist government? Now, of course, when you hear Italy and NATO allies, you must think Operation Gladio. And, of course, our man Webster Tarpley was commissioned by the Italian government to investigate and write about the murder of Aldo Moro. And there's a video, there's a series of political assassination documentaries, hour-long. You can watch the entire hour-long episode about Aldo Moro, as well as RFK, and on and on. If we jump to Winter Patriot, this is a follow-up from a story way back in MediaMonarchy.com archives. But terror's still trivial when it's not Muslim. Ronald Swerlane, an amateur rocket enthusiast from Longmont, Colorado, pleaded guilty last week to 3 counts of illegal possession of explosives in a deal which seems likely to keep him out of prison. And it goes on with a little bit of the legalese, but basically, if we hit the flashback from June 2007, police seize huge cache of explosives, and we basically had to say, if this would have been a brown person, they would have been screwed. But because it's a dopey white guy, it's no big deal. Diving into a bit of last week's 9/11 news, 9/11 Memorial to be completed by, 2012. This from The Gothamist. Now that the Port Authority doesn't want to give unrealistic or phony timelines about projects at Ground Zero, it's clear many projects won't be completed on time, like the long-awaited 9/11 memorial. And we heard some of that in the previous articles. There's a lot of links in there, all around, from The Gothamist and Monsters and Critics. We also have an update from The Washington Times. Retractable dome dropped from the memorial's plans. The World Trade Center's owner announced a major design change to its multi-billion dollar transit hub, the World Trade Center Transportation Hub. And that was the day after concluding that most of the projects at Ground Zero are behind schedule and over budget. A weird one if we jump to the AFP. 9/11 canine hero to be cloned. And no, it's not a human, it's a dog. A dog that sniffed out survivors from under the rubble of New York's World Trade Center after 9/11 is going to be cloned by a California-based firm conducting the procedure. Tracker, a German Shepherd who lives with his owner, James Symington, in L.A., was picked by BioArts International as the most clone-worthy. Now, what's interesting is we've had stories up about dogs who sniffed for survivors at Ground Zero, and they're dead. One of the clips I'm not going to be able to play, but is Daniel Hopsicker at the New England 9/11 Truth Symposium in Keene, New Hampshire, back in May. It's a great hour-long speech, but I can't get into it. Daniel Hopsicker, investigative journalist, author of Barry and the Boys and Muhammad Atta and the Venice Flying Circus, or Welcome to Terrorland. But if we jump to the AP, study shows spiritual effects of magic mushrooms. This is also an update, and there's a video to go along with this from Raw Story. In 2002, at a Johns Hopkins University laboratory, a business consultant named Dee Dee Osborne took a psychedelic drug as part of a research project. She felt like she was taking off. She saw colors. Then it felt like her heart was ripping open, but she called the experience joyful as well as painful and says that it has helped her to this day. And there's another positive drug story. Here's Bob with the weather. We're back to June 30th, but a little bit about presidential selection and terror threataganda. We've heard a little mention of our good friend Joe Israel First Lieberman. He, however, made the note that, of course, our enemies will test the new president early. And this was on Face the Nation. So check out this little bit from our man Lieberman.
We need a president who's ready to be commander-in-chief on day one. Senator McCain is. Incidentally, Senator Clinton said that over and over again. She was right. She was ready to be president on day one. Why? Because our enemies will test the new president early. Remember that the truck bombing of the World Trade Center happened in the first year of the Clinton administration. 9/11 happened in the first year of the Bush administration. John McCain is ready to take the reins on January 20th, 2009. He doesn't need any training.
So there's Joe Lieberman on Face the Nation, of course, always pointing out that there'll be inaugural terror attacks. The other bit comes from Frank Rich. If terrorists rock the vote in 2008, don't fault Charles Black, the John McCain advisor, for publicly stating his honest belief that a domestic terror attack would be, quote, a big advantage for their campaign, and that Benazir Bhutto's assassination had helped McCain win the New Hampshire primary. His real sin is that he didn't come completely clean on his strategic thinking. Basically goes on to say that, of course, they need terror, they want terror. And if we jump to the Denver Post, Terror Watch uses local eyes in Colorado. Hundreds of police, firefighters, paramedics, and even utility workers have been trained and recently dispatched as terrorism liaison officers in Colorado and a handful of other states to hunt for, quote, suspicious activity. And that can be anything they want it to be here in the nanny state. I mentioned Collateral News Episode 47. That one's called Ship to Nowhere. And that's, of course, about the story we hit up a couple weeks ago, that basically the Navy has floating prison ships so they don't have to say that they're anywhere. So that video is there, Collateral News number 47, Ship to Nowhere. If we hit up NTV, this is a video I grabbed from their website and posted up to YouTube. Weird weather, heat burst, blasts Nebraska.
Ozan had a rude awakening this morning when a heat burst hit their town. Temperatures jumped 20 degrees in a short period of time, and winds hit speeds of more than 75 miles per hour. The burst came without warning, and many residents didn't know what was happening.
There was this loud crash, and the house shook, and I thought, oh, the roof's coming off. So I even looked up to see if the roof was still there, and it was. And the house quit shaking, so I thought, well, you know, I was afraid there was a tornado. All I could think about was get my kids down to the basement.
Many residents woke up to find trees crashed onto their homes, even cars. No injuries have been reported.
Weather wars, my friends. It's the lightning round. Last few minutes of the show, we're going to blast through. Seymour Hersh, of course, reported that the U.S. is escalating covert operations against Iran. Congress agreed to a request from President Bush to fund a major escalation of covert operations against Iran. So, of course, we're already operating covertly inside Iran. And, of course, you should check out Operation Ajax when we already overthrew Iran back in 1953. If we hit up the Washington Post, thousands in southwestern China riot over alleged cover-up. Thousands of people thronged a police station in southwestern China to protest the alleged cover-up of a teenage girl's rape and murder. And it is at least good to see that still people in one of the most repressive regimes in the world will still get out and fuck shit up. If we jump to Press TV, Mugabe, sanctions and sham elections, of course, in Zimbabwe, Robert Mugabe steamrolled ahead to another victory. And one of the interesting subnotes to this, and there's a lot of links and a lot of articles posted up, but from the Times Online, Mugabe henchman backed by Barclays Bank. Barclays is flouting European Union sanctions on Zimbabwe by providing two of President Robert Mugabe's most senior henchmen with bank accounts. And of course, we mentioned Hitler and the Bushes, and of course, Prescott Bush and Union Banking Corporation, you know, funding the enemy. If we hit up YouTube, our man Ron Paul, campaignforliberty.com, warns Congress on virtual war resolution. There's a good speech. He's talking about the upcoming H.R. 362. And, of course, it's basically going to be a none-too-veiled authorization to attack Iran. My man Alex Ansari has Outside the Box episodes 158 and 159 posted up. On 158, he's got documentary filmmaker Chris Everard of EnigmaTV.com. There's also episode 159 and also a bunch of episodes, of course, from his show on We the People Radio Network, WTPRN.com. And actually, Wednesday night on the 9th, I had the pleasure of being with about 10 other people to join Alex Ansari at Laughing Horse Books in downtown Portland for his live episode on We the People Radio Network. That's July 9th, so you can check that one out and you can hear me hogging the mic a bunch. If we hit up Raw Story, Raw Replay, military satellites to spy on domestic disasters, MSNBC's Alex Witt talked to Newsweek's Michael Isikoff about new proposal by the Bush administration to use satellites for domestic surveillance. And of course, they say it's going to be, you know, for the military, but they also leave open the possibility that this could be used for other purposes. And if we jump to the New York Times, this goes along with a well, spying across the pond, NAU and EU to trade private data. I, of course, added in NAU, but, you know, we'll be in it soon enough. The U.S. and the EU are nearing completion of an agreement allowing law enforcement and security agencies to obtain private information like credit card transactions, travel histories, and internet browsing habits about people on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean. And it, of course, would represent a major diplomatic breakthrough for American counterterrorism officials. I bet it would. Last clip. This one's important. This one pops up again and again, and at the top of the show, I said we were going to mention Jerome Hauer. So we're back now to, of course, the mysterious, never-solved anthrax attacks. But the latest on this, from last week, U.S. to pay Stephen Hatfill $5.8 million in the anthrax operation settlement.
And I'm just told that we have some breaking news. Obviously, it's on the justice front. So let's go to Pete Williams in Washington. What's going on, Pete?
Chris, well, this is a big development in the investigation and the subsequent fallout of those anthrax mail attacks that followed right after the 9/11 attacks in 2001. You may recall those anonymous mailings that went out and eventually caused serious disruption here in Washington, in addition to injuries and some deaths of some postal workers. One of the people who was caught up in the investigation was a former Army scientist named Stephen Hatfill, who was once described by the Attorney General as a person of interest in the case. His lawyers have long said that he had nothing to do with it. Hatfill himself has made a number of tearful public statements saying that he was wrongly accused. And just within the last few hours, the Department of Justice, the United States government, reached a legal settlement with Stephen Hatfill in which the government will pay him over $5 million for suggesting that he was a person of interest. Now, the settlement says that the government does not admit any fault. This is sort of standard legal settlement language. This should not be construed, the government says, as an admission of liability or fault on the part of the government or any of its employees. But what this means is you can safely say Stephen Hatfill is no longer a person of interest in the anthrax case. The Justice Department would simply not reach a legal settlement with someone on Friday and then charge them with the crime the next week. So I think you can safely conclude that the United States government has formally washed its hands of Stephen Hatfill as a suspect in the anthrax case or a person of interest. This is the settlement agreement that was just signed today. There is the signature of a government lawyer, and right under it is the signature of Stephen Hatfill agreeing to this settlement. Now, under the terms of the legal agreement, the government is going to pay him just over $2.8 million and then buy an annuity contract for him worth $3 million. So you put the two together, it's roughly $5.8 million as a result of the government one time calling Stephen Hatfill a person of interest. You may recall that federal agents were tailing him, searched his house, searched a residence that he had, carted things away, searched an apartment, followed his car, had bloodhounds go to a restaurant where he had once been. He also complained that he had gotten, after he had difficulty finding a job around here in Washington, that he had gotten a job as a consultant to a university, and that the U.S. government, the Justice Department, called the university and suggested that he would not be a good person to have as a contractor working to train people to work with hazardous materials. So this is a big development in the anthrax investigation. The government reaching a settlement with one-time person of interest Stephen Hatfill in the anthrax investigation, an investigation that still goes on. And as of just today, law enforcement officials tell NBC News that they do not believe any indictments are imminent. So this is not a sign that somebody else is about to be charged, but it is a sign that the government has washed its hands of Stephen Hatfill and will also pay him over $5 million.
All right. Thanks, Pete. Appreciate that.
All righty.
Two addendums to the anthrax inside jobs. FDA issues warning on Cipro. This from the AP. Drug safety officials Tuesday imposed the government's most urgent safety warning on Cipro and similar antibiotics. Of course, Cipro became a household name during the anthrax attacks of 2001. And of course, we found out that Jerome Hauer had the White House on Cipro, the anti-anthrax drug, the week before 9/11. Second update, who planned the anthrax attacks? A great article by our man Justin Raimondo over at antiwar.com. And of course, I said it before, I'll say it again, Fort Detrick, Maryland, Philip Zack. Let's end on a slightly fun note. And of course, when you think fun, you think exorcism. Texas High Court rules exorcism protected by law. From the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, a divided Texas Supreme Court ruled in favor of a former Coleyville church last Friday, saying church members who were involved in a traumatic exorcism that ultimately injured a young woman are protected by the First Amendment. In a 6-3 decision, the court ruled that the Pleasant Glade Assembly of God staff's efforts to cast out demons from Laura Schubert presents an ecclesiastical dispute over religious conduct that would unconstitutionally entangle the court in church doctrine. Schubert described a wild night in 96 that involved casting out demons from the church and two attempts to exorcise demons from her. The incident left Schubert physically bruised and so emotionally scarred she later tried to kill herself. She was 17 at the time. So there you go. Exorcisms protected by law. My friends, in the last few moments, let's look at some of the creepy customers coming to MediaMonarchy.com in the past week. We had USACE.Army.mil. Headquarters. We also had the United States Centers for Disease Control. We had the Houses of Parliament, in.parliament.uk. They googled BBC announced Tower 7 collapse, which they did early. Baltimore Gas and Electric Company, the Library of Congress Information Technology Services. They Googled Magic Mushroom State Law, West Virginia. Computer Sciences Corporation out of Falls Church. We had the Fort Worth Star-Telegram Googling Avery McDaniel. And I forget what his name is related to, but Google it. State of Connecticut hit me up from SourceWatch, reading about the NSA. The U.S. Government Printing Office, they hit me from a link, apparently, in someone's Yahoo Mail. But we had the DOD Network Information Center, ns.dia.mil. They Googled Maine Corps Inslaw, and that is disturbing. Department of Veteran Affairs hit me up from blacklistednews.com. The BBC Googled new BBC hit piece and landed here. Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Studios MGM. They Googled Red Dawn plus MGM. Insurance Testing Corp in Minnesota. We're reading about how the world's going to end in 2012. We had the BBC again. And finally, we had IBM Canada Lab Aldo. And they hit me up for my link on wakeupfromyourslumber.com. My name's James M. Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com. This has been episode 83. It's July 11th, 2008. I thank you for listening. I appreciate it. Let's keep watching. Let's keep helping. Let's keep communicating. I love you. We'll be here next week. It's MediaMonarchy.com. Like my man, Webster Tarpley, says, get active or get radioactive. Take care.
Police would get him just the same.